At the outbreak of World War I, Aussies swarmed to enlist in what was generally regarded as a praiseworthy endeavour. We tend to regard the enlistees as honourable, brave young men, which no doubt most of them were, but looking at that from a different perspective, author Russell Robinson gives us food for thought in Khaki Crims and Desperados. Now, I'm a believer in not sanitising history to suit the general outlook or expectations, because we need for history to be known and shown, warts and all. Otherwise, we'll never learn how to overcome or avoid the unsavoury aspects of life. Russell Robinson joins us today in the studio in a telephone hookup interview. Hello, Russell.
Oh, good afternoon, Helen, and thank you very much for inviting me on the program.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you on here, and congratulations on your book.
Thanks very much.
Russell, what is your background? Do you have any particular military interests, and what caused you to write this book?
Well, Helen, I don't have any military background. Suffice to say that I spent most of my working life in newspapers, and I've been a journalist for, dare I say, 50-plus years, and I've had a great time. And most of that has been spent reporting, and in my latter years, my latter working years, I might say, I've been involved in true crime. The book follows on from another book that I co-wrote several years ago with a British barrister who's a crime writer as well, James Morton, and it was about the Painters and Dockers. Now, the Painters and Dockers weren't that ferocious in South Australia, but along the eastern seaboard, they were shockers, and they were involved in organised crime. And it was from the 1930s onward that they wreaked most of their havoc in a criminal sense. Quite a number of these were ex-servicemen. And when they joined the Painters and Dockers, they'd been in the army. But let me say, they didn't have a very, constructive time in the army. A lot of them went AWOL, a lot of them were in jail. But that military experience gave them a certain edge, and they were able to carry on their criminal activities with a fair bit of discipline. It was quite interesting because at one stage I had to interview a couple of old jail warders who'd been, looking after these people at Pentridge Jail in maximum security. And it was the old warders who told me of their military training. And these old warders themselves were ex-servicemen. And so there was a link between the two. And they told me that these prisoners, despite the hardship of the conditions, were able to withstand it because of their training. And that was the basis of the book. And then we started to look at World War One.
What an interesting angle to come in at it from. And from there, how did you go obtaining all of the other data that you needed, the research data?
So I left the Herald Sun a couple of years ago, and I devoted my time mainly to full-time writing. So I was able to devote all that time to research, and that was spending a lot of time in Canberra, in with the National Archives, in with the State Archives here as well, and also going through the State Library, looking at the newspaper cuttings, and being able to cross-reference a lot of the names with when they appeared in court and the sentences they were given. It was quite an arduous process, but I've got to say, Helen, I enjoyed it.
Well, the end result is that the public has got a book that makes them stop and think about World War One and World War Two and the enlistees that were in it and how it reflected into and from their civilian life. Now, you've actually dedicated this book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I dedicated it to my grandfather, Tom, who was in the Second World War, not the First World War, but the Second World War. And it's a very sad story because Tom was an officer. He wasn't on the front line, but he was an engineer, and he was responsible for the repair work on all the weapons that would come back through the line and hopefully keep our soldiers safe. Tom was quite a brilliant man. He was, he was an engineer. He was very mechanical. But one day, and this was in Syria, one day he was riding his motorbike through the desert, and a mile away in an Australian camp, a soldier was cleaning his rifle. And the rifle accidentally discharged, and the bullet struck my grandfather.
Oh, my goodness.
And killed him.
How terrible.
Straight into the heart, and he died. Absolute tragedy, and left my grandmother a widow and my mother without her father. Mm. And for years and years, they had this gnawing feeling at the back of their mind that maybe there's more to it, maybe something else happened. And so, fast forward 20 years and 20 or 30 years, and my mother was able to access the army records, and she wrote away and she received a report. And sure enough, that's how he died. And my mother went to my grandmother and said to her, "Mum, we've now really confirmed that this is what happened, and I've got the name of the man who did it." And my grandmother said, "Well, yes, Rosalie, I know that man." And my mother said, "You know that man? Well, why didn't you tell me?" And she said, "Because he'd suffered enough. He'd suffered enough, and that was the end of it."
That's a very generous outlook, isn't it?
It's an amazing.
And after all, what good would it have done to have tried to seek any outcome from it?
Exactly right, Helen. And the sad part is that he lived in a neighbouring suburb. And my grandmother knew all along that's where he was living. And she thought to herself, "No, I'm not going to wreck two families."
Your grandmother was a very wise woman. Thank you for sharing that insight into your grandfather and how unfortunate that would happen. Getting back to the criminals that joined up, how did they get into the Army and the Navy and the Air Force in the first place? Because I presume it was across the three services.
It was mainly infantry, and there was some in the Navy as well, Helen, but it was very, very easy to get into the Army at that time because initially there was a huge turn-up to the enlistment centres that started to peter out. As the war continued and the body count mounted, it was becoming difficult to get fresh troops. I'm sure your listeners would remember that there was a big debate on referendum and the conscription, and it didn't get through. However, there still remained a dearth of troops, and you were finding in the courts a lot of the magistrates, and I'm talking about petty criminals, not serious criminals, but petty criminals, were being given the option of either going to jail or joining the AIF. Now, it wasn't official, but quite a number of magistrates would say, "Well, look, you're looking at 5 years here, or you might want to serve your country in a much better way, in a more constructive way." And that's how it happened. But there are also, Helen, a lot of troops who were on the run. And they saw climbing into khaki as a means of escaping their responsibilities or escaping the law, escaping wives, dare I say, children, family responsibilities, debts. So you really had quite a number of men who also enlisted under different names. But that's not to say that they committed crimes while they were overseas.
What sort of crimes had they been guilty of before joining up?
Oh, mainly theft. A lot of assault, but serious assault, not murder. There were never any, to my knowledge, never any criminals guilty of capital offences who were...
Sure, and when you consider that Australia in that period actually went through some really tough times, and it may have been very easy to be recruited into the world underneath the veneer of so-called decent society, especially if there was no work and you've got a horde of hungry mouths to feed at home.
Oh, you're so right. Different times now. I don't think we can imagine what it was like in those days, and you wouldn't claim to. But at the same time, there were men and women in those armed forces who were good, decent people, who enlisted for proper reasons and served their country well.
And I would say that they were in the great majority.
Absolutely in the great majority. Yes, quite right.
So does the mindset of war set a person with a predilection for crime further along that path?
No, I don't believe it does. A lot of the people that I write about were criminals before they joined the AIF, so they're on that path. A lot of them were redeemed. A lot of them came out better people, but a lot of them came out worse people too. So it's really an individual thing, isn't it?
Of course. Any very noticeable ones that improved their life?
Well, my favourite is George Harris. Mm-hmm. And George is a wonderful story of a man who grew up as a street urchin and lived by stealing from people and assaulting people on the streets in Sydney. He finished up in jail after a serious assault on a woman that he claimed he was innocent of, but nonetheless, he was still a hardened criminal by that stage. And George, at Parramatta Jail, tried to stab to death the deputy governor.
Oh, goodness.
Who was doing an inspection. And George had a knife hidden up his sleeve, a makeshift knife, and he stepped out of line and lunged at the deputy governor and stabbed him several times before he was dragged away. And George was then sent to an asylum where he escaped and did more damage to the community. He was eventually sent back to jail, and he befriended the Attorney General, the State Attorney General at the time, who was a wonderful man. He was a prison reformer. And George said, "I am innocent," and that the Attorney General did his own investigation into that, the assault on the woman, and said, "Yes, there's enough doubt about this case to think that you deserve a retrial, or if not a retrial, then a reduction on your sentence." The two of them then decided that if George was released, he would immediately join the AIF, and that was in 1916, and he was released, and he was true to his word. He went straight to Brisbane, and he joined the AIF. And George was part of the Machine Gun Corps, which was a very dangerous job, incredibly dangerous. He was on the front. He didn't man the gun himself, but what he did was carry the bullets from post to post, which again was an incredibly dangerous job, and unfortunately he was shot and killed. And what happened is his commanding officer then wrote a letter to the Attorney General, who by then had retired, but wrote a letter lauding George for his bravery. It's a wonderful story of redemption.
So was George decorated for his bravery?
He wasn't. I dare say quite a number of soldiers weren't decorated for their bravery. But I've got decorated soldiers who were also given their medals while they were in jail. So it cuts both ways, doesn't it?
I can understand somebody with the mindset of a criminal being able to sort of push the boundaries in a combat situation.
Yes, quite a number did push the boundaries, and quite a number of the criminals that I write about didn't make it to the battlefield simply because they spent a lot of their time in isolation wards suffering from venereal disease, which a lot of it was self-inflicted because it would give them 90 days of relative safety. And they were constantly contracting that disease. And some of them were even joining crime gangs outside their bases, crime gangs established by local criminals using Australians. That was a fertile ground for people to join these crime gangs and wreak havoc on the streets of London and the regions.
And was the military interested in tracking them down?
But the trouble is it was so difficult because a lot of the focus was on the battle. This is on a war that was costing Australian lives. And if your attention's taken away by a number of criminals, it's very difficult. It was very difficult for the AIF.
Very bad. Mm. So has your research thrown any light on where in particular the most pockets of criminally active men came from, or even their socio-economic sector?
Everywhere.
Everywhere?
Everywhere. But it was predominantly blue-collar, I hate to say. It was struggle town for a lot of these people.
Exactly.
And they grew up in hard times, and frankly, that was the only life they knew.
Well, Russell, it's been really interesting chatting with you about Khaki Crimson Desperados. Thank you for talking with us today.
And thank you for inviting me too, Helen. It's been great.
It's been a pleasure.